Now, we were speaking yesterday about the King James Bible. And under that, under A, we were looking at the previous history of the English Bibles. And there we reached the Great Bible, and then we just glanced forward very briefly. But before we go on to look a little more into detail into the next developments in relation to the Bible, I'd like to mention number 7. 6 was the Great Bible. 7 we'll barely mention. It's the Taverner Bible. Capital T-A-V-E-R-N-E-R. Taverner was a very fine Greek student who worked very hard preparing his own translation. And this was issued but did not catch on. There were only 2 printings of it. I would not mention it except for a very special fact, which we'll bring out later. But in the history of English Bibles, it in itself is not particularly important. It appears at about 1540, just at the end of the time when Henry was permitting and to some extent encouraging production of Bibles. Number 8 is Henry's last years. And that we looked at yesterday very briefly. I'll just remind you again about it, that during these last years, Henry swung back vigorously to the religious ideas of his early life. And he burned many men at the stake for teachings which would have been readily accepted 10 years earlier. In fact, at one time when he was on the continent, he returned to find that charges of heresy had been brought against his own wife, Catherine Parr, the last of his 6 wives. And he had quickly quashed that attack against her. There was quite a bit of publicity a few years ago about a play called The Ladies Not for Burning. And reading references to it, I found that it was based upon this episode in the life of Catherine Parr. She would seem to have been a fine Christian woman, and one who was devoted to the Reformation. Strange thing is that during these years of persecution of Protestantism, that Cranmer managed to keep his position as Archbishop of Canterbury and to keep Henry's favor, so that when Henry died, he made Archbishop Cranmer the guardian of his son, Edward. Well, of course, Henry insisted during these years he was head of the Church of England. The Pope had no authority in England. He was head of the Church of England. And he did not interfere with the great Bibles which were in the churches. But he gave orders that people should not disturb church services by standing around and reading the Bible and discussing it. He gave orders that people who did not have a great deal of education should be discouraged from reading the Bible or from discussing the Bible. There was no new publication of Bibles during these last few years of his reign. Number 9 is Edward VI. And Edward VI, as you remember, was the son of Jane Seymour, a Protestant, and he was a very precocious youth. He reigned from the age of 10 to the age of 16, from 1547 to 1553. Actually, of course, there was a Council of Regency that did most of the governing, and the members of this council were constantly opposing one another, but at least 2/3 of them were executed before the end of the 6 years as other groups would gain control and accuse those they defeated of treason and execute them. But in some measures, the boy king exerted his authority, and Cranmer, as far as religion was concerned, had full freedom during this period. I mentioned to you yesterday how the story is told that when they brought Edward, the boy, the 3 swords, he was to be crowned, the swords of the 3 kingdoms, that he said, "There's a 4th sword more important than any of these." And someone said, "What is that?" And he said, "That is the sword of the Spirit, the Word of God." And whether the little boy thought of this himself, whether Cranmer suggested it to him, whether it was the development of ideas he had in his head before, or even whether Cranmer and others planned it as something that would
give a strong Protestant emphasis in the course of the coronation would be impossible to prove today. But it gives a good picture of the spirit that reigned as far as religion was concerned during Edward's reign. The great mass of the people of England were as yet quite uneducated, knew very little except that the churches to which they went had their services in English now instead of in Latin, that the Bible was available there. Some of these people were reading them. Instead of looking to the Pope as the head, they now looked to the King as the head. The bulk of the people were not yet very much informed of religious matters. But the educated class, the merchant class, the people who were active in England, they were very largely Protestant, and they moved forward vigorously during this period of the reign of Edward VI. And so during his reign, there were many publications of Bibles, that is, reprints of the Bibles that had already been prepared. And there were many men studying the Bible and studying the Hebrew and Greek to see which of these versions represented the actual original best and where the idea could be better expressed in some other way. There was, in this portion, the active portion of the nation was strongly Protestant. But then there were the old hereditary nobles who had inherited great tracts of land and important positions and great wealth in the country, but who many of them tended simply to enjoy the luxuries that were theirs. They were not particularly forward-looking or active, most of them. They maybe wanted to make a good position in the army or navy or something like that, but they tended to be conservative and were quite ready, the bulk of them, when Queen Mary took over, to recognize the Pope again as the head of the church. So you have these different groups. But during this reign of Edward VI, Bible translation did not move forward much because the emphasis now was on the prayer book. The prayer book and the plans for the services and all that, to which Cranmer devoted himself assiduously, and great advances were made in these lines. Also, Cranmer was studying Calvin's writings a great deal now. And Cranmer had been a very close follower of Luther in his early days, but now he swung his interest largely to Calvin. Of course, this was right after Luther's death. Calvin's writings were being more and more read, and Cranmer was more and more bringing the Calvinistic emphases into the prayer books and the other matters that he was writing. But all that Cranmer did is characterized by beautiful English style, very fine productions from a literary viewpoint, and they bring out the gospel and the great doctrines of the faith very clearly, but Cranmer was not a strongly controversial type. If he had, with all the changes in Henry's attitude, he wouldn't have lasted anywhere near as long as he was. And the result is that the prayer book that he wrote and the various services he introduced and so on do not take a strong stand such as will arouse hatred in the hearts of those who oppose it. They take a clear presentation of the great doctrines, but often in such terminology that those who disagree are apt to perhaps not realize at first just how much different it is from their view, and perhaps gradually be won by it rather than a straight, firm disagreement. Nobody with such an attitude could have lasted long with Henry, because Henry took enough of that attitude for the whole country. And people of all views, the leaders of all views, were killed during his reign when he happened to take an opposing position. But Cranmer survived through this reign. It was a great time of Bible translation, of Bible publication, Bible distribution, and interest in the Bible, and a great time of popular preaching and spreading the knowledge of the Word. But it was not a time when there was as much done in Bible translation as 10 years earlier. Then number 10, the reign of Mary. And of course, as you know, during the years from 1553 to 1558, I hope you all have those dates well in mind, during those 5 years, Mary did everything she could to bring England back to complete loyalty to the Pope. And as far as the great inert mass of English people was concerned, this did not make a great deal of difference. But the mercantile class, some of them fled, others tried to outwardly conform, and leaders in the church, there were 2,000 out of 6,000 ministers who lost their positions as soon as Mary took over, refused to return to loyalty to the Pope. The leaders of the church, most of the bishops, fled to the continent. And if she had lived 30 more years instead of 5, probably England would have become like Poland became, and like France became 100 years later, these countries in which the Counter-Reformation went up. But since she only lived 5 years, the result of it was that the people admired the great constancy of the Reformation leaders as they were burned at the stake. They saw poor cowardly Latimer, who was signed a dozen statements of admitting he'd been wrong in his life and so on, in fear of torture, saw him when it came to the end bravely stand there and denounce his right hand for having signed these cowardly statements and hold it unflinchingly in the flame until his whole right hand and arm was burnt with crisp. And then, of course, he died in the flame. And the result was, so long as the persecution was ended in a few years, the result was that those who had witnessed it and heard about it were one to have a great admiration for these Protestant leaders. And, of course, another effect of her reign was that so many of the leaders of the church had been at Geneva studying with Calvin during these 5 years. So that when, after Mary died, these folks came back, you had a Protestant leadership that was better trained and even more enthusiastic in what they believed in than they had been before Mary came to the throne. So in the case of England, God providentially acted to protect and enlarge the Reformation movement, though he did not do so in Poland, nor eventually in France. And those nations, for a period of 3 centuries, hardly anybody had a chance to even hear the gospel. The 3 following centuries, after having had a tremendous advance of the gospel before it was snuffed out by the Counter-Reformation. Now, number 11 is the Geneva Bible. And the Geneva Bible was the Bible that was made by the exiles in Geneva during Mary's reign. A number of fine scholars participated in this. It was a very excellent translation. It was a translation which came to be hated by the enemies of the Puritans, not for its actual content, but for the many notes in it, which took a very strong anti-papal stand and took a very strong stand for a Presbyterian sort of control of the churches. That is to say, for the people having the voice as to the control of their local church, and the people's representatives directing the church and their representatives meeting together to ensure the keeping of sound doctrine in the other churches throughout the area. And these various notes here and there in it irritated King James tremendously. And those who opposed the Calvinistic attitude were tremendously irritated by the notes in the Geneva Bible, even though if you take any particular verse and say, what do you think of the translation, they'd have a pretty hard job proving that it wasn't a very good translation. And this Geneva Bible became the popular Bible of the English-speaking world. It never was authorized for use in churches. But for the use of the people in their homes, it came to be the Bible that was most widely used, and continued so for a whole century. Up until about 1650, most of the earnest Christians who spoke English used the Geneva Bible, whether it be in America here, whether it be in Great Britain, wherever there were English-speaking people who in their homes were studying and reading the Bible, the Geneva Bible, or as people popularly called it, the Breeches Bible, was the standard Bible. I think I mentioned once before why it is called the Breeches Bible, because in Genesis, where it says they took fig leaves and sewed themselves aprons in the King James Version, the Geneva Bible says they took fig leaves and sewed themselves breeches. So they call the whole Bible the Breeches Bible. You had a question, Mr. McCarty? During these years, 1553 to 1558, they were working on it, and some continued, worked a little longer. It was sometime between 1560 and 70 that the copies began to reach England. I'm not sure the exact date. That is, I don't have it right at hand. But it's right in that period. Yes. Geneva Bible, then, was one which had a very great vogue. It was 40 years after the King James Version came out, before the Geneva Bible was displaced. Now, number 12 is the Bishop's Bible. And the Bishop's Bible was issued in 1571. I would guess that the Geneva Bible was already beginning, at least, to get wide circulation before the Bishop's Bible came out. But the Bishop's Bible was prepared by Elizabeth's bishops, and some of these were very learned men and probably did some very good things in making the revision of the Great Bible, which they called the Bishop's Bible. It was a step forward for a Bible for the churches to use, but it probably was not nearly what it might have been if these bishops had had more time. But they were very busy with trying to get the church reorganized after Mary's reign, trying to get things well settled and established. Most of them were very earnest Christians who were anxious to spread the knowledge of the word, anxious to encourage the prophesying, as they called them, where the ministers would meet together once every 2 weeks, and each of them would preach about 15 minutes on a text that was assigned, beginning at the youngest and going up to the oldest, going through this, and Elizabeth was trying to get these prophesying stopped and giving definite orders they be stopped. And then there were other Christians there who felt that all the falderol of special garments put on and off and bowings here and there and that sort of thing ought to be done away with. And like Calvin did, the emphasis simply put on the word of finding what the word meant. And Elizabeth was against that sort of thing, and the bishops were sort of in the middle, so that it's easy to see why, under the circumstances, the job was not what these particular men might have been capable of doing if they'd been able to devote a great deal of time to it. Archbishop Parker distributed the work, giving different bishops different parts to translate. It was put together. It was it had some very excellent things in it. It was doubtless an improvement over the Great Bible, which they used as the foundation for it, and it was put into many of the churches. Some still had the copies of the Great Bible in them, but the people having the Geneva Bible at home to read were often quite dissatisfied with the Bishop's Bible, which didn't seem to them to be nearly as good a work. From 1571 on, this was the Bible that was appointed to be read in churches and was used in at least two-thirds of the churches from that time up to when the new King James Bible was prepared. Then number 13 is the Reims and Douay Version. The Reims and Douay Version. Reims, capital R-H-E-I-M-S, a French city. I believe it's in Belgium. Is it Belgium or northern France? I forget. But it's in that area there. And at that place, there were a group of Catholic Romanist refugees from England who had gone there because they were unwilling to recognize King Henry as the head of the English church. And they wanted to stand for all the superstitions of the Middle Ages and for the absolute supremacy of the Pope, and so they founded an English college there to prepare men to come to England and to try to win England back to Romans. And these men set to work to prepare a translation of the New Testament. They could not, as they had done in previous years, simply say it should be forbidden to the laity to read the Bible. It must be read only in the Latin and only by the members of the hierarchy. They could not do it because the Bible was already widely spread in England. And according to their doctrine, the Bible is God's word and the foundation, even though they say that along with it there is tradition that has been passed on privately, though nobody can prove there is any such thing. But they give that as a support for the various superstitions that developed in the Middle Ages. But the Bible, according to their theory, to the theory of the Roman Catholic Church up to within the last 10 or 15 years, the Bible was God's word, the infallible, inerrant source, even though they didn't think anybody could understand it except as the hierarchy explains to them what it means. Well, under the circumstances, they could not refuse to argue about the Bible, and when their people found other people reading the Geneva version, their answer could not be, that's not God's word. Their answer to some people would be satisfied with being told, yes, but the ordinary person can't understand it, and you have to read it in Latin, know what it really means anyway, so you must ask the priest what it means. Under the circumstances in England, it was necessary to have a Bible available for them to read too. And so they set to work to prepare the Reims version. It came to be called that because it was made at Reims, of the New Testament. And this translation of the New Testament, which came out in these latter years about the middle years of Elizabeth's reign, the New Testament came out. And then a few years later, some of these people who had moved their headquarters to a place called Douai, D-O-U-A-I, issued a translation of the Old Testament. And the two were united together and often are spoken of as a whole as the Douai Bible. And that remained until within the last 30 years, the most commonly used Roman Catholic Bible of the English-speaking world. Yes? Well, these were probably like the Revised Standard Version, where they had an Old Testament committee and a New Testament committee, though theoretically both approved the full. I don't know the exact inner details of their organization. It was a continuation of the same project. It was definitely a continuation of the same project. It was the preparation of an Old Testament to go with the New Testament already prepared. But in most of the time, in the last few centuries, the whole thing has been called the Douai Bible, even though originally the New Testament of it was spoken of as the Reims New Testament, because it was prepared there at Reims. But then at Douai, they prepared the Old and put the whole thing together. Yes?
Was it translated
to this translation was definitely from the Latin. All these others we have looked at are from the Greek and the Hebrew. This was from the Latin. But we must note this, that even Roman Catholic translations made in the last 30 or 40 years will say on their front cover that they are made from the Latin, but they're apt to say with a consideration of the Greek and Hebrew or something like that. Because according to the claims of the Romanist Church, our Greek and Hebrew documents have been altered and twisted. They don't represent the original. It's only the Latin, Jerome's translation of 480, which represents the original. Of course, the fact of the matter is nobody knows exactly what Jerome wrote because there's tremendous variation in different documents, different copies of the Vulgate. But according to their theory, the Vulgate represents the true Bible. We even find among Protestants some who try to make out the King James Version. It represents the true Bible, or the particular Greek and Hebrew that was exactly back up. It's similar, the attitude they take toward the Latin Vulgate. But these scholars included men, some of whom at least, were very familiar with Greek and Hebrew. And they doubtless took it into consideration at many points in their interpretation. But they claimed to be a translation of Vulgate, and doubtless in many points where the Vulgate was different from our Greek and Hebrew, it was the Vulgate that they fought. Now this Douai version had some good things in it. They found there are places where they made some excellent translations. Anyone who makes a Bible translation may make some things in it that are very excellent. Because the biggest job in translating isn't determining what the original means. That is a big job and a very, very vital job. But a harder job, yes, is after you know what the original means to say that in your own language. You give me three sentences in German, and I read those sentences and I know exactly what they mean. But if I'm going to explain to you exactly what they mean, it may take me three paragraphs to explain it. And if I am to make a translation of these three German sentences into three English sentences, a translation which is about the same length, if I just go word for word, it's apt to give an entirely different impression. Just an interesting little illustration occurs to me. Our English word high, the German is hoch, and our English word sight, our English word time, the German is Zeit. But you put the two together in German, you say Hochzeit, and it means a wedding. I heard of two Americans who were at a German party, and they had a very good time. They wanted to say we had a high time. They said we had a Hochzeit, which would mean we had a wedding. And it's just that way with any two languages, even as close as English and German. The little nuances and the differences of meaning in the arrangement of the idioms is such that a word-for-word translation is an impossibility. You have to learn how that language expresses ideas and use something that will express those particular ideas. I remember we used to have a riddle when I was a boy, what's black and white and red all over? And the answer, of course, was a newspaper, which is black and white and red all over. But someone was at a German party and they tried to translate into German. What's black and white and red all over? Well, the German color red is rot, and the German word for R-R-E-A-D is gelesen. And rot and gelesen don't sound the least bit alike. And you simply cannot possibly translate it. I remember the first day in Germany, I finished my meal, and I was in a hurry to leave, and they didn't come and bring you the bill. They don't bring there until you asked for it, at least they did in those days. And I looked up my little English-German dictionary in my pocket to know what bill would be, and it gave two meanings. One was schnabel and one was rechnung. And I didn't know whether to ask them, bring me the schnabel or bring me the rechnung. Well, fortunately, there was a German-English part. I looked up and found schnabel was the bill or beak of a bird. So I said, if I said, bring me the beak of a bird, they would wonder what kind of a crazy person I was. Well, those are just a few illustrations of the difficulty with two languages which are fundamentally as near each other as English and German are. Now think of two languages as far apart as Greek and English, or much further apart as Hebrew and English. And to make a word-for-word translation is very difficult. I've often had people say, why should I spend time studying Greek and Hebrew? I can't expect to make as good a translation as these great scholars make. And I say, of course you can't. You probably couldn't make one a tenth as good as what they can make. But you can look at the Hebrew or the Greek, and you can see many things, if you know Hebrew and Greek, that are perfectly obvious to you, which would be difficult to explain, but they're perfectly clear to you what it is, what it means. You could explain it in several sentences. The purpose of it isn't so that you can be an authority on the difficult things. It's so that you can see many, many obvious things that are very difficult to explain in the other language. And that is why it is of great value to know the original, if you want to get exactly what any document means. Well, when it comes to making a translation, particularly for people who don't know the original, a word-for-word translation may just give no meaning at all. There was a man named Aquila in the about 200 A.D. who was dissatisfied with the Septuagint and decided to make a new translation of the five books of Moses that would go word for word in the Greek and tell exactly what the Hebrew was. And so he began in the beginning, that was easy enough to put into Greek, God created, that wasn't difficult. But then he came to Es, How would you translate F in the Greek? Well, F can be the sign of the accusative or can mean with. There are really two different Hebrew words, each of which is expressed as F. There is no Greek word or any more than there's an English word for sign of accusative, but there is the Greek word sun, which means with. So he said, I'll put in sun, and then it's perfectly clear that means F. So the Aquila translation says, in the beginning, God created with the heaven and with the earth. Now, if you already know Hebrew, the word sun shows you this sign F is there. But if you don't know Hebrew, it's absolute nonsense. And that you're very apt to get into when you try to make just a word-for-word translation. So it is very important in translation to learn exactly what it means. And we can make great progress yet on it. There's much in the Bible that with further study we can tell exactly what it means in a way that has not yet been recognized by anyone, or that certainly at least is not in any translation. But the bigger job, if you're making a translation, is putting what is quite clear in the original into that language so that people who don't know the original language at all can get a pretty good idea of what the original says. And the result is that the poorest translator may hit upon a way of rendering a certain phrase in his own language that exactly gives the meaning of the original. And so the Douay version and the Reims New Testament, the Douay Bible as they call it, occasionally hit upon a very excellent way. I've done a great deal of study of the book of Isaiah. And there have been times when I've taken a verse of Isaiah and I've seen exactly what it means, but how could I put it in English? It didn't get the meaning from any of our common translations. I've tried and tried and not seemed to find a way. And then I've looked in James Moffat's Old Testament and found that he translated that verse in such a way that there was exactly the idea of the Hebrew in English. And you just had to admire the skill of the man in getting exactly that idea. But the trouble is, James Moffat, being a rather extreme modernist, you go on to the next verse, which may be perfectly clear what it means, and he throws it away and puts in what he thinks Isaiah ought to have said. So out of in Moffat's translation, maybe four verses are absolutely useless, and the fifth is a wonderful gem. It just shows how any translator may hit upon a wonderful way to express the idea in his own language. And so all of these translations have their values. Now the Douay version has a very great disadvantage to it. And that is that being dedicated to the preservation of the Latin church, of the emphasis on Latin, and to the idea that the Latin is the true presentation of truth. When they didn't know just how to say it in English, they were apt to just take the Latin word and put an English ending on it, or leave off the Latin ending. And so the Douay version has all sorts of words in it that just don't mean anything to an English-speaking person. Now, where in Philippians, our King James says that he emptied himself. Now, there's been great argument what that means. Jesus certainly didn't empty himself of his knowledge or of his divine character or of his power. It simply is his glory, we believe, and he emptied himself. It's not a particularly good way to say he gave up a great deal of his glory, which is what it really means, but for the time being. But that the English doesn't really get that. I don't know how to get it in one word. But when the Reims transversion came to that, they simply said he ex-Annonited himself. And what English-speaking person would have any idea what ex-Annonite means? And where it says in the Lord's Prayer, give us this day our daily bread, and they said this is a reference to the communion, to the Mass. And so they said, give us this day our supersubstantial bread. Now, of course, the Greek word there occurs, I believe, nowhere else in the New Testament. It is difficult to know exactly what it means. But they translated our supersubstantial bread, and there are great many words in the Douay version, which are Latinisms, and which the average person would have no idea, really, what they meant. And so, among Protestants, it's never had any great vogue. In fact, The greatest vogue that had ever had among Protestants came from the fact that an Englishman decided to show how superior the Geneva Bible was to it, and so he printed the Geneva Bible in this in parallel columns with a discussion of the reasons why he thought the Geneva Bible was better, and probably three times as many of that were distributed as there were actually of the Douay version during that particular decade. And through that, it became somewhat known among Protestants. But it has continued to be leading Romanist Bible until within the last few years. Now, about in the middle of that period, there was a great Romanist scholar who did make many revisions of it. So the present form is quite different from the original form, but still continues to be called the Douay version. And so these are the Bibles that were in existence at the time when King James had his meeting with the Puritans in the Hampton Court Conference. And when the Puritans suggested that we ought to have a new Bible translation that would be more accurate to use in the churches than the bishop's Bible, and some of the bishops who Elizabeth had put in, who were standing for the authority of the church and the supremacy of the king, said, oh, they said, everybody will want to translate the Bible in a different way. We ought to be satisfied with what we have, and we're ready to scornfully condemn the Puritan suggestion. To their surprise, King James, who in general agreed with them right down the line and scolded the Puritans in strong language, at this point he said, well, now that sounds to me like a very good idea. He said, we ought to have a really good translation that everyone would use. And he said, I think the Geneva Bible is the worst translation that ever was made into any language. And if he didn't like it, the people were using that in their homes. It does not support the divine right of kings, at least in its footnotes, the way he wanted it to. And he said, that is the worst Bible ever made. And he said, there are weaknesses in the bishop's Bible. I think you have a good idea there. And then the 19 churchmen who were standing there in the meeting, they immediately kept quiet when the king spoke, and the king proceeded to say, I will take measures to get a new version of the Bible. Yes?
I can see where King James is writing the Bible, but it's the most good translation by the Puritans, like, well, why did they want a Bible?
Well, now we would have to get into their minds to know that. And it's altogether possible that if we would read extensively in their letters and writings of that day, we could come up with some pretty good evidence on it. I personally have not done that in order to, it might be you'd have to go to England to find them, I don't know. But I could make a pretty good guess about it. My guess would be that they recognize, for a minor point, they recognize that though the Geneva Bible was an excellent Bible, it was an improvement over the previous ones. And they were good scholars, they were well-trained people, and they knew that it is difficult to make a perfect translation. They knew that while they much preferred it to the bishop's Bible, they knew there were places where the bishop's Bible got the sense of the original better than it did. They could see that the process of improving translation was something that would be good to continue still further. But I think more important than that, I think they recognized that, according to law, the bishop's Bible was the one that had to be read in the churches. And they knew the king would never agree to read the Geneva Bible in the churches with those footnotes it had, and they wanted to have a Bible in the churches that would be a better Bible than the bishop's Bible. And so instead of saying, let's get rid of the bishop's Bible and read the Geneva Bible, which the king would have just, in horror, thrown them out altogether, instead of that, they proposed a new translation better than either one, which they realized was really a good thing. Each of these Bibles had, to some extent, represent a step of improvement over the previous one. And so King James agreed to this. And so we go on to B. We've been all this time on small a. We've spent an hour and a quarter, I guess, on the background of the King James Bible. But I thought, rather than take each of these up at the particular point in the history, it would give you a better idea of the development to go through it this way continuously. And so now we go on to B, the production of the King James Version. The production of the King James Version. And under this, number one, King James's part. A Now, King James might be a might have great grandiose political schemes, wanting to be the one who arranges all the affairs of Europe and settles relations between nations and get the thing all mixed up and end up with failing in everything he tried of that type, and then sit back and forget about the government for a time and enjoy his particular types of pleasures. And he might be very poor in many different lines, but he had a genuine interest in scholarship. And he had been brought up among people who were discussing the Bible constantly. He was a thoroughly convinced Calvinist himself. And he now had the opportunity to do something of the sort of thing that he liked doing, that he enjoyed doing, and that he had the background to do rather well. And so he took this up on his own initiative and proceeded to make the plans for it. Now, he took no part in the translation, but he made plans to make a good translation that would represent the accumulated results of 80 years of Bible study. And so he made his plan. The church leaders did not do it. I don't know if they had anything to do with it. He simply said he was going to do this, and in the course of the next few months, he proceeded. And he made a plan to have six companies of scholars. He got the universities of England to make recommendations as to scholars who were trained in Hebrew and Greek and who would be good to be on these committees. I guess we'll put that under small two, the selection of the company. The selection of the company. He got the universities to make recommendations of first-class scholars, of whom there were great many at that time. And from among these who were recommended, he selected certain ones, and it would appear that he did it on a very good basis of selecting in accordance with their scholarship and their fitness for this particular task. There was a certain amount of variety of viewpoint on theological matters among these men, but there was absolute unanimity among them that the Bible is God's word, that every part of it is true and free from error. And on the great Christian doctrines, there was absolutely no divergence whatever among the members of this committee. And so these men were selected, and then arrangements were made to give them a stipend for their time. He did not have any great amount of money available to him at the time. James didn't. He was always spending more than the government was making available for him, but he thought of a very clever way of recompensing them. He assured them that if they did good work on the committee, they would be kept in mind for good, well-paying positions in the church in subsequent years. And he sent out word to the various bishops that if they had well-paying positions that came vacant within the next few years, they were to save some of them in order to give a reward to the people who did good work on this committee. And eventually, several of the members of the committee were made bishops, and others were given good positions in the church. That was not a very fair way of recompensing, because there weren't enough of these positions to go around, and some of them probably received very little of future recompense for it. But of course, in those days, money didn't mean as much as today, because you couldn't buy a TV or a train ride. None of these things that everybody's got to have money for today could have been secured for any amount of money in those days. And so they didn't feel particularly slighted when they didn't get much more money than they would have normally. But they were all men who were interested in scholarship, interested in the work. And most of the best scholars of England were on this committee, with the exception of one. There was a man named Broughton, B-R-O-U-G-H-T-O-N. And Broughton was quite generally recognized as the best Hebrew scholar in the country. But not only was he the best Hebrew scholar in the country, he knew he was. He knew it so well that nobody else could work with him. He would constantly tell what he thought of what anybody else did in Hebrew study in a way that made almost everybody dislike him. And it was the general feeling that he would simply wouldn't be able to work with people. And he had made some translations of some parts of the Old Testament, and nobody seemed to like the translations. He may not have had particular gift in English style. But he felt there were much better translations than anything anybody else had made. But he was not on the committee. But aside from that one black, it was probably the best scholars of the time. Professor Montgomery of the University of Pennsylvania said in my hearing a few years ago that he did not believe that it would be possible today out of the whole world to get a group of Christian scholars who would be so familiar with the Jewish commentaries, the Talmudic writings, the various Jewish discussions of the meanings of parts of the Old Testament written in Hebrew, as these men were in England at that time. They were similarly trained in the study of the Latin commentaries of the early Christian fathers on the New Testament. They were men of very great scholarship and knowledge. And as I say, every one of them was a man who thoroughly believed that the Bible was true and free from error. Now they were divided then. That's the selection of the company. Let's make number three, the plan of work. Now the plan of work was that the company was divided into, the group was divided into six companies. Two of these would meet at Oxford, two at Cambridge, and two in London. There's a section of London where Westminster Abbey is, which is called Westminster. And London is actually divided into about six different sections that have special names like this. They speak of that then as meeting at Westminster, meeting at this section right in the heart of London. So two met there, two met at Cambridge, two met at Oxford. Each of the six companies, as they call them, had a sixth of the Bible. And each man was to take this sixth of the Bible and make a translation of it. And then the company came together and they compared the translations each man had made and discussed the differences and tried to make them to work out a good translation of it. They, I think there was one defect in this, and that is that while theoretically the whole group would go over the whole translation, I personally do not think they did. Because that was in the New Testament, there's a difficult question when you translate. When you translate a New Testament word like alias, what are you going to do? Are you going to take that Greek word alias and make it Elias? Or are you going to recognize that's the Greek way of saying Elijah and translate Elijah? Well, we find that in a portion of the New Testament, this committee wanted to use one method, and in another portion they wanted to use another. So you will find that in the Gospels, it says in John, art thou Elias? And you get over to James and says Elijah was a man of like passions with ourselves. And we have thus the same Greek word exactly, alias, which represents alia in the Hebrew, translated Elijah in the Old Testament and Elijah in the Book of Names, but Elias in John. And that, of course, is quite confusing to the person who doesn't know Greek or Hebrew. And thus, there are certain differences like that between the sections, as each company evidently did what it thought was best. And we have a little difference in policy. Now, that's not a great defect in it, but it does seem to me it would have been better to have been consistent. And if you're going to use, the Douay version is apt to use the Greek or Latin form, use it throughout. And if you're going to use the Hebrew form, then when you're speaking of a Hebrew man, use it throughout. But to have right in the New Testament two different forms for exactly the same Greek does not impress me as a particularly good system. Now, this was the plan of work, number four. Now, three, number four will be the instructions. The instructions. King James gave specific instructions to them. And on the whole, the instructions were a very reasonable, well-thought-out basis for procedure. There's one point of them which was not very wide, and that is the point of saying that the bishop's Bible is to be the foundation. The bishop's Bible was to be the foundation. Where there was disagreement, they were to stick to the bishop's Bible. But they were to bring into consideration with it other translations. And here he mentioned Coverdale and the Great Bible and the Geneva, and mentioned a number of these. He didn't mention the Reims, the Douay version. But he mentioned these others, that they were to compare. And they also compared Luther's translation. And in fact, many of the King James versions, it says on the front page that it was diligently compared with the Deutsch and the Latin. Deutsch meaning German. Diligently compared with Luther's works, Luther's translation, and with the Vulgate. And it really is not a translation, it's a revision. About three-fourths of it is identical with the Bishop's Bible. I've heard it said that 9 words out of 10 are exactly what Tyndale, are the very words that Tyndale put in originally, even though they modernized the spelling somewhat over what Tyndale had the spelling of a century earlier. But they compared these, and his directions were very good on the whole, except for this of making the bishop's Bible be the foundation. But they did a very excellent piece of work. And we will look at reasons for its excellence next Tuesday.